What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, or watching it, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. And today's our first foray into doing like film and television, total experiment. And we're going to go deep on a movie that was big for me growing up. I've probably seen it 1,000 times. I'm not kidding. I'm talking about the 1998 cult political comedy, Bullworth, starring Warren Beatty, co-written by Warren Beatty, directed by Warren Beatty, and co-produced by Warren Beatty. And my guests today are the perfect people to share insights about this movie and what it says about us then and now. New friend of the pod, Colette Shade, and returning champion Matt Duss. Do you guys want to say a quick word about yourselves?
Sure. Hi, I'm Colette Shade. I'm a writer, and I've got a book coming out probably sometime in 2024 with HarperCollins called Y2K, Pop Culture at the End of the American Dream. It's a series of personal essays that expand into broader political, cultural analysis about the years 1997 through 2008. And to clarify, that's the dot-com bubble through the financial crisis in 2008. If you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at Ms. Shade. That's at M-S-S-H-A-D-E.
Hey, I'm Matt Duss. I'm a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Previously, I was a foreign policy advisor for Senator Bernie Sanders. Really glad to be back on the pod. And usually, you know, we spend some time talking about foreign policy before we get to the real stuff, which is talking about movies. So glad to be here to just get right to the real stuff.
That's right. Skip the main course, go straight to dessert. I guess I should say some stuff about background of the movie and like just the facts, and then we can get into some interpretive whatever. So I don't know how much this matters to people. It was on a $30 million budget. It just about broke even at the box office, not quite. But it also didn't have wide distribution for reasons that we'll probably talk about. It was extremely well received by critics. I think on Rotten Tomatoes now it's got 70-something percent, which is pretty solid. And it got nominated for a bunch of awards. So the ones that matter, best screenplay, best actor, best motion picture, best supporting actor, best music video for Ghetto Superstar, right? It takes place, the synopsis, in 1996. This is when Clinton is going up for re-election. And it's the story of J. Billington Bullworth, a California senator, once very liberal, but by the 90s, he finds himself kind of selling out and running for re-election on what at the time was called like third way liberalism, which was basically a Republican agenda with a Democrat label on it. And he's so depressed by his own soullessness that he takes out a $10 million life insurance policy on himself. He hires a hitman to kill him. And then with nothing to lose, he starts speaking truth publicly about political corruption and the extreme racial and class divides in society, the need for social democracy. And then the kicker is that he's doing all of this in the form of rhymes. It, like he adopts or appropriates a hip hop affect.
You know, it ain't that funny. You contribute all my money. You make your contribution, then you get your solution. As long as you can pay, I'm going to do it all your way. Yes, the money talks and the people walk.
Yo, Bank of America, this table over here, Wells Fargo and Citibank, you're really very dear. Loan billions to Mexico and never have to fear, because taxpayers, take it in the rear.
And the movie kind of bounces between settings in South Central and the hood and political events and political fundraisers and talk shows around L.A. And in his revival of like a principled leftism, like it kind of emerges out of his truth telling. It makes sense once you piece together that like he worked for Bobby Kennedy back in the day, which Warren Beatty really did. He met Huey Newton and MLK. He was a civil rights activist turned new leftist at one point, which was also true of Warren Beatty. But then at some point, all of that for Bulworth curdled into being on the take and like playing the Washington game. And that's basically the story. Am I missing something here?
Yeah. Yeah. You've got it. All right. No, and all these photos that they show in the beginning in Bulworth's office are actual photos of Beatty, you know, with Huey Newton, with Robert Kennedy.
I don't think I realized that that was really Beatty, but that makes sense. I mean, Beatty was a huge Democratic Party guy who, it's funny because just before this, my husband and I watched Reds, which was a movie he also starred in. I believe he also directed and did all this other stuff with, but it's basically about this communist journalist in the, basically during the Russian Revolution, who goes with his partner to Russia to cover the revolution. And
It's about, you know, John Reed. I never watched
Reed.
It actually, but I know the John Reed story. Wow.
Yeah, honestly, it's amazing. And, really, I highly recommend it. It's a huge project. I mean, it's got so many people in it, like Bulworth. But
yes, well, it's John Reed, and then you've got Diane Keaton as the name's escaping me, but
Louise Bryant.
Yes, thank you, Louise Bryant, and then you have also a co-starring role of Eugene O'Neill as played by Jack Nicholson, which is, I think, one of the best roles in the movie.
Yeah.
All right, I need to see
it's a
this.
Really, it's a great, you know, grand sweeping. One of the, in the old VHS days, it was two tapes.
So yeah, exactly. Super, super long. You don't feel like you're watching something super, super long because it's just scintillating.
Did you guys watch this when it came out? Well, Colette, you were like fifth grade or something when this came out.
I was in fifth grade.
So probably not.
So one, I had zero interest in this because I felt that politics were boring, as I told my parents at the dinner table, because that's what we were always talking about in D.C. Yeah, I wasn't allowed to watch movies with violence. And there's definitely a little bit of violence in there. And so that's, you know, that was a no-no in my household.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater when it came out.
It's a pretty vulgar movie. I mean, yeah, like it's not for kids for sure. I mean, this movie was my introduction to politics. Like, we'll talk about this later, but like the whole hip hop idiom made it the perfect vessel for high school van. So I saw it, you know, like it was a time in my life from like 97 until I went to basic training in June 2000, where I was going to the movie every single weekend and sometimes on the weekdays to see everything that was there, even like, you know, romantic dramas and stuff that would not be on theme for a dude in high school. It's just every single movie I was consuming it. And then this was part of it. And the hip hop stuff made it like uniquely, I don't know, amenable to my mind. In Orlando, where I grew up too, like the Ghetto Superstar song was everywhere.
I remember this song.
Yeah, you couldn't miss it on the radio and stuff. Yeah,
it was everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, the politics of it, I remember, because, you know, short version here is that I took a very long meandering path to finish undergrad. And I was in one of my periodic sabbaticals, let's say. But I had, you know, already earlier in my college career been, you know, turned on, as one gets turned on, to Chomsky and all those kinds of arguments about, you know, manufacturing consent, and certainly was, you know, very sympathetic to the critiques of Clintonism that this just is savage about, you know, what you refer to as third way liberalism. And you see it here, like adopting like the family values. And we believe in a hand up, not a handout, like the end of welfare as we know it bullshit. So I remember seeing it. And again, I was not unfamiliar with these kinds of arguments, but it was striking to me. It was like, wow, is this stuff actually breaking through? Because it's in a Hollywood, it's in a big Hollywood movie with a big Hollywood movie star and all these other movie stars. And I think, you know, looking back, you can argue that this really was starting to break through, right? Because I also think these arguments, people don't like to talk about it now, but this is what also eventually fed Ralph Nader's candidacy, was this exact critique. You know, and Nader was vilified post 2000 because, you know, people blame him for handing the election to George W. Bush. You know, it's, you know, Democrats always, you know, whenever they lose, they always find someone to blame. That year it was Ralph Nader.
Susan Sarandon,
you know, which isn't to say there aren't legitimate critiques of Ralph Nader's decision to continue running. I think there are. But I'm just, the thing that I remember was this critique really did start to break through around this time.
Yeah, you can't miss in the movie and in Warren Beatty's own like public commentary that how deeply sour he was on Clintonism and the fact that like there was no alternative because the alternative was fucking Bob Dole Viagra commercials or whatever, you know, white supremacy with Viagra, like is horrible alternative, you know? And so Bulworth emerges in that context. Colette, you wrote about, I mean, so this book that you just finished, it's all about like Bulworth falls squarely within your time span.
It does. Yeah.
A lot of people who listen to the show are like Gen Z and this is not something they even lived through. Could you, I don't know if scene setting is the right phrase, but like describe what is the mind palace of this era? I mean, you know, politically, culturally, socially.
Oh, hey, this is great. and if you all don't mind, I'm going to delve into a little bit of the biographical too. But first start with the kind of broader currents. So the Cold War was over. 1991, the Cold War was over and we won, baby. We won. We're the sole global hegemon. The European Union was, you know, had just come together, was in the process of kind of hammering things out. There were all of these trade treaties that we were in charge of, like NAFTA and CAFTA, and we were just spreading free trade and unregulated post-industrial, or not post-industrial, but post-unionized commerce all around the world. And
it was the end of history.
It was the end of history, baby, as Francis Fukuyama told us all in his best-selling book. And then you also had, so you had like this real sense of excitement and possibility. And then at the same time in 95, you had the web coming into people's houses, right? So if you're Gen Z, the internet is just part of infrastructure, right? It's like, for me, it was like, okay, you make a phone call. That's not exciting. It's always been around. But I remember the exact specific day in 1995 when my household got hooked up to the internet, right? So you've got that. And then what starts to happen is there is this speculative boom starting in 1997 and ending in early 2000 of tech stocks. So you have, it's called the dot-com bubble, and you just have this belief that, okay, well, yeah, you had deindustrialization where you had all these like kind of decent middle-class union jobs that were cut, and particularly in like black neighborhoods, like auto plants were closed and offshored. And so you had all these, you know, this increasing inequality, these poor people, this increasing racial inequality, also an increase in the carceral system, just kind of cracking down on all of these people who were out of work, who didn't really have a lot else to do but sell drugs. And it was all kind of masked by this stock market bubble, which even Alan Greenspan, the Fed chairman and arch libertarian, he called it irrational exuberance. You just had this total ecstatic sugar high over the stock market. And like Wired magazine in 1997, they had a cover that said, the quote was, the long boom, we're facing 25 years of prosperity, freedom, and a better environment for the whole world. You got a problem with that?
I teach that. I teach that issue in a course on strategy, because it projects out 25 years and it's like, well, what did they get right and wrong, you know?
Yeah. Wait, that didn't happen?
Well, what's funny is it's just like you said, Colette, like it was such Tale of Two Cities, like end of history for whom, you know? There was a sugar high triumphalism driven by techno-utopianism, you know, on the one hand, and then on the other hand, in the shadow of the new techno empire, minorities and disenfranchised classes, the underclasses of society, were as bad off as they'd ever been. I mean, it was the culmination of war on drugs. Yeah. And it was getting bad. And the 90s was like when gangs peaked, really, and Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just also like just remember like when this movie opened, the political environment, right? So it opens in May 98.
Yeah.
5 months before is when the Clinton affair scandal broke.
Mm, that's
so
important.
We are very much in the middle of all of that. Having kind of lived through it, and was certainly very, you know, politically aware and engaged, you know, not at the level I am now, but still, you know, as someone who was paying pretty close attention to that stuff, it, you know, I see it that as kind of, you know, really, you know, accelerating the kind of, you know, the polarization and the kind of negative partisanship that it just infects our politics now.
Yeah.
But that's true, but also what's so ironic is that then in the 2000 election, the whole joke that was kind of accepted by everyone, even people who were partisans for one side or the other, was, oh, well, gee, both of these guys are the same. George W. Bush, Al Gore, they're kind of offering the same thing. Cool. They're both offering unregulated anti-union capitalism, and, you know.
Yeah. And again, and some of them, you know, some people thought that was great. And, you know, again, but that was Nader's critique too.
I mean, exactly.
He called them Tweedledum and Tweedledee. And in retrospect, I think that was an overstatement. I think we found that. In fact, no, there are very important differences.
Yeah.
In what these two guys have in mind, but it was especially in what you're saying in terms of their approach to trade and generally in neoliberalism, it was very much the same. They were not offering much, much different on that. And I think that is very, very key, because this movie does, even though it certainly deals with issues of race, you know, if we're going to get to what some of the key parts of the movie, for me, it's that speech that Halle Berry gives when they're sitting in the limo.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
She just breaks it down, you know, as she explains, I'm a materialist.
So who walks in the room?
Huey Newton.
You know, a lot of people I talk to, they're black at your age, they have no idea who he was. Why do you think there are no more black leaders?
Some people think it's because they all got killed. But I think it has more to do with the decimation of the manufacturing base in the urban centers. Senator, an optimistic, energized population throws up optimistic, energized leaders. And when you shift manufacturing to the Sun Belt and the Third World, you destroy the blue-collar core of the black activist population.
Some people would say the problem is purely cultural.
The power of a media that's continually controlled by fewer and fewer people.
Add to that monopoly of the media a consumer culture that's based on self-gratification.
Now, you're not likely to have a population that wants leadership that calls for self-sacrifice.
But the fact is, I'm just a materialist at heart.
If I look at the economic base, high domestic employment means jobs for African Americans. World War II meant lots of jobs for black folks. That is what energized the community for the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s. An energized, hopeful community will not only produce leaders, but more importantly, it'll produce leaders they'll respond to. Now, what do you think, Senator?
And I don't want to break into it, but we just got to pause for a minute and I think recognize that Halle Berry just owns this movie.
100%.
I mean, she owns this movie the way Ingrid Bergman owns Casablanca, man. As soon as you see her, you're like, when she's not on screen, you're like, where'd she go? Why
isn't she on screen right now?
All the flavor of the movie comes from her presence. Yeah. She has a gravitas.
Yeah. I mean, and that says a lot, because again, this movie has a murderer's row of great characters.
Dude, I was going to use that exact phrase, murderer's row.
Did you? Sorry. You may have used it in an early email, so I apologize. But like Jack Warden, and you know, and we also have to get to at some point Ennio Morricone, who, in my view, the greatest film composer of all time. Wasn't doing a lot of work.
Know that he did. I'm not like a super expert on him. I just know, you know, an ex of mine who's a major cinemaphile is just, you know, loves him. But yeah, I didn't know he did the soundtrack.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, of soundtrack. I mean, there's a lot of hip hop in it, but, and there's not a lot of kind of symphonic, but there is a bit, and it's very effective because he's brilliant.
Yeah. I loved the musical overlay of this movie so much, and of course it was all anchored in the hip-hop. They had like NWA songs and all that, but there were the actual Star Wars like compositions in the background, like soaring music at just the right moments. Like it hit emotional registers that really made a difference. And that's clearly obviously him. What else has he been involved in?
Morricone. I mean, he wrote like wah na 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 wah wah wah, and like one of the like the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I mean, he did all the
Oh,
music for
yeah.
all of Sergio Leone's westerns with Clint Eastwood. He did the Battle of Algiers. He
Oh my
did
God.
the
Okay, one
music
of my
for
all-time
the
faves. I did not know
Untouchables. I mean,
that.
it's
Oh,
the list
wow.
is long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty
Yeah.
serious.
And he came out of one of his last that he did was basically came out of mostly retirement to do The Hateful Eight for Quentin Tarantino.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so he's got the movie's got A-list composer, like award nominating winning soundtrack, Halle Berry, Don Cheadle, Oliver
Don
Platt,
Cheadle.
Oh yeah, that was amazing.
yeah,
I was
the
not
gangster.
expecting to see him there. Because keep in mind, when I watched it a couple weeks ago for this podcast, I had never seen this movie before. And
Oh my God.
Don Cheadle has a great monologue. His monologue is
Yeah.
I would say second to Halle Berry's for
I
like
agree. That's right.
correctly, yeah, correctly analyzing what's going on, and linking as not that many people were doing at the time, and certainly not on, in
Yeah.
Hollywood, linking what was happening in, in inner cities, basically, with what was happening at a structural policy, macroeconomic level. And that was awesome. And that predated The Wire, because The Wire, I think, came out in 99 or 2000. So,
Yeah, no, that's very well said. That's a great link right there, because that's really what it is. I mean, I would, I think this movie, I mean, Halle Berry was a star, but this movie really broke,
Made,
she
yeah,
broke
made
through with this in a bigger way. Cheadle, I would say, really broke through a few years before this in a Devil in a Blue Dress, if you've ever seen
which
that.
I really want to see it. It's funny.
Yeah.
I was just I think
No.
I was Googling Don Cheadle
Yeah.
filmography, and I was like, oh, I've never seen or read Devil in a Blue Dress, and I'm like, I really need to see
Yeah,
that or
it's
watch
great. I mean, it answers the question, how many people can actually steal a movie from Denzel Washington? The answer is one. It is
one.
one person. It is Don
He's
Cheadle.
pretty special. I knew him from Colors. He played a Crip gang leader in the
Right.
80s, and like that was
Right.
a
No, I
big
think
shock
that
too.
was one of his first. Yeah.
You would think like, okay, he's the way he's playing a gangster in Bullworth, like maybe he's being typecast, but Devil in a Blue Dress
Right.
is like totally orthogonal to all
He's a
that.
detective. Oh, and I just wanted to say, like, the thing that I liked about Halle Berry in this movie is just, I mean, I love the femme fatale character in general as a type in films. And I just think that, like, it was such a cool update how she's this femme fatale, but she's like this radical black woman, but she's really on the take for this assassin, but she's playing this seductive radical black woman, which is like the fantasy of Bulworth,
Right.
which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yes, it plays totally because his own political consciousness clearly started in the civil rights movement, and he's see like his politics forms around black activism, black radicalism, and she is some kind of not ode to that, but she's like bringing that back out, you know. It's like the perfect the most attractive thing for somebody like him, you know.
Right.
But
She's
it's
like, she's not just, your typical femme fatale will appeal to a kind of down and out hero by, reminding him of being young or whatever. And she is doing that, but it's with a twist. It's with this
Yeah.
political twist.
Right, but I think she also what's interesting is like he part of the character of Bullworth is that he sort of imputes a very special kind of authenticity to black culture that he wants to use to redeem himself, which in its way is a kind of prejudice. You know, it's like
Sure,
you are
absolutely.
redeeming yourself is your own job. It's not the job of
Black people.
of others or black people or anyone else.
Yeah.
You know, so really, I mean, this moment, the movie captures a moment when not only this political critique was starting to break through, but hip hop was breaking through,
Yeah.
right?
Oh, yeah.
What came out in 1998, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, which
Biggest
dominated
fucking album ever. Yeah.
the Grammys. No, I mean, that's, I think that album, you know, the following year, it won like an armful of awards,
Yeah.
and really signified, you know, hip hop is the music that
Yeah,
dominates our culture
and then
now.
prior to that, you had the deaths, both you know, within months of each other, of Biggie and Tupac. You had sort of from that sort of post that dovetailing with that, you had the bling era where you had like the rise of Southern hip hop. But yeah, right. Like hip hop had really at that point gone from being a genre of music that was still somewhat marginal and seen as, in at least in the sense of like popular culture, which was still at that time overwhelmingly white, to being basically usurping at that time rock and roll's role.
It became something that you would hear in Pottery Barn.
100%, exactly, exactly.
I feel some type of way about all this because, like, I'm clearly like I'm. This all this stuff made me in a sense, like I have no identity outside of it. But at the same time, like the period, like once the bling bling stuff started and Puff Daddy and the shiny suits and shit, that was the neoliberalization of hip hop. And so it's like it used to be this 100%. Subaltern truth telling medium. And then it starts going in this like greed is good kind of.
Yeah. But what's funny, too, is I think that the bling bling era, that it actually was one of the few venues where we could explore what was actually happening economically, even whether or not that was on purpose or not on purpose, right? Like, I think about how Jay-Z said Coke prices up and down like it's Wall Street homes, you know? Like, he's drawing an explicit link between his time as a drug dealer, a street drug dealer, and you know, in the Marcy Project, and this neoliberalization of this economy, this winner take all economy, and the violence that occurs at these high levels of people getting laid off and stuff like that, that's not coded as violence, even if it's like causing people to be homeless and not have healthcare. But if you shoot someone over a turf war for property of, you know, for the corner that you're selling dope on, like that's coded as crime. And I think in that way, by reflecting the latter, hip hop allows us to see the former a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. You had this book that you just finished writing. There's a part of it where you deal with hip hop in this era and white people. Maybe it's the same chapter you're talking about, but so like my political consciousness comes from hip hop, you know, but then like, Marco Rubio is one of my contemporaries. He's just a fuckface reactionary version. Yeah. And he also thinks that Wu-Tang is the shit. And so like, what are people who are actively seek to like perpetuate racial capitalism and racial hierarchies, what is it that they're getting out of hip hop? It's the art form of the oppressed, right? And so like, what the fuck is, what are they doing? What do they see in it? What do they get out of it? What's going on there?
A lot. I mean, it's why do they like it? What are they getting out of it? Because it does seem paradoxical that someone who wants to explicitly lock up black and brown people loves Wu-Tang.
Yeah.
But the thing is, so I have this theory that I explore in this essay. Hip hop is, and this was informed by a chapter I read from a book called Wages of Whiteness by David Roediger, where he writes about the history of minstrelsy. And he talks about how minstrelsy in the 19th century was a way to emphasize whiteness, and particularly for like Irish immigrants who are trying to get a piece of the pie, they could say, hey, look, we're dressing up as black people, so we can't be black because we're pretending to be black, right? If you're putting on a costume, you're not that thing. And it was a way of comparing themselves to these black stereotypes. You know, they could be the upstanding white people, and then the people who were they dressed up as for the entertainment of other white people, that was, oh, those, you know, those are criminals, those are lazy people, those are people who are sexually unable to control their sexual and other appetites, right? Whereas we can, we're white. And this really functions fundamentally in the same way. And now I want to be very clear, because I think that there's, I'm talking about an affect here versus just being a fan. And I think that it's the orientation toward the music and your prevailing attitudes that really count here, right? So when you have someone like Marco Rubio listening to hip hop, my guess, based on like Republicans I've met throughout my life, like Republican fraternity boys, for instance, who love hip hop, white ones, they're listening to it and they're finding it kind of funny, right? Like, ha ha, I'm rich and white, not poor and black. Like, look at those people over there. That's why they deserve to be in prison, because they're out there dealing drugs and, you know, they're the materialistic ones who are living off ill-gotten wealth, and they're the ones who are abusing women. Definitely not me in a fraternity. I'm not abusing women, guys, right? And so it's a way of both defining your own whiteness, and then it's also blaming and justifying mass incarceration and racial capitalism. Does that all?
So they're listening to it and they're hearing these stories of disenfranchisement and being like, "Well, them's the breaks. To eat shit. Too bad. I'm glad that's not me." That's horrible.
I think actually that is part of it. And again, that's not conscious. I don't think they're saying I'm going to listen. No. This is all sort of subconscious, but I do think that, yes.
I mean, I'll say, I know that some conservatives also listen to enjoy hip hop because they see it as an affirmation of capitalism, the hustle.
Oh, sure. That also makes 100%.
Straightforwardly.
So they're finding something. Sure. Yeah. I know if,
you know, and some people, you know, who knows why Marco Rubio enjoys it, or you know, someone like, you know, Paul Ryan, who talked about, you know, loving listening to Rage Against the Machine
or his
workouts, which caused Rage Against the Machine, or Tom Morello, I guess, to kind of tweet at him, "This is definitely not for you, man.
Stop. Yeah. Cease and desist."
But that's just it. It is. It's for anyone who wants to listen to it. I mean, that's how art works, and who knows at what level anyone can enjoy it. But I do think it's a very valid question of what do they think when they're hearing this stuff.
Yeah, no, and I think, and again, like, I don't really, I'm skeptical of any kind of cultural analysis that's about sort of punishing people or saying, "Oh, you're being a bad white person. You're not a good ally because you're listening to hip hop wrong." You know, I can't read people's minds. Yeah. I just think it's interesting to kind of theorize these things.
Yeah.
Because it is weird when somebody is like, "Oh yeah, I love hip hop, and also I think you should be in jail for 20 years for dealing drugs to survive, and also you shouldn't get health care."
Well, I misunderstood. Like, this stuff was so formative for me that I assumed for a long time that, like, if you were a hip hop head, then you obviously had my same sort of like radical inflected politics or like progressive ideals, you know? And so, like, I was at a extremely hawky national security think tank, a primacist think tank, the worst of the worst in some senses, and people who know me know what I'm talking about. And one of the bonding, like, sources of solidarity among us socially, because we were all on the younger side, was Tribe Called Quest. And we, like, talking about hip hop in the context of, like, which war are we gonna fucking plot next? And, like, the hip hop stuff made me assume that, like, we clearly all have the same larger vision that we're working towards. And it just happens to be that, like, warmongering is the theory for how we get there. And the more I spent time with that, the more I saw that as, like, just a wildly ridiculous dead end and not good. But the hip hop obscured the horribleness of the theory that we were operating on, you know, because it was like, "Oh, we all are of the same milieu." And that was not the case at all.
It also makes me think of, you know, and this doesn't quite have the race component, but it makes me think of the Grateful Dead and Phish. So it's huge. I don't know if you guys know this, but a lot of Republicans, Tucker Carlson loves the Grateful Dead, Ann Coulter loves the Grateful Dead.
There's
a strong tradition. Oh yeah. So there's a strong tradition of, like, people in prep schools loving the Grateful Dead, and Republicans for whom, you know, there's a decent, you know, overlap there of these people loving the Grateful Dead. And I think when I first learned that, I was very surprised, because I always thought, oh, that's a hippie band. That's for peaceniks. That's for people who, you know, vote for Ralph Nader. But obviously it's not, that's not the case. So I just, you know, I think it also is, it's also that as well. It's that merely liking something or liking a certain style of clothing or a certain style of music, that's not enough. That's not politics, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, people just listen to it at whatever level they get into the culture, right. They get into the sound. You know, you'll have, you know, a lot of conserve, you know, who will get into punk rock, right?
Exactly.
Are they hearing it? I mean, yeah. Or even, you know, Southern rock from the 70s, which was, you know, I think white people hip hop, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. was the sound of working class, well, like the Allman Brothers, Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Lynyrd Skynyrd was pro-Confederate, so weren't
well,
they?
I mean, they became that. They yeah. definitely did become that. You know, I'm certainly not going to defend the Confederate iconography that they use, no question.
Or the song where they talk about how great the governor was who prevented school integration.
Yeah, satirical. Sweet Home Alabama.
That is
again,
the Southern working class, though. I mean, that is the prevailing working yeah. class attitude.
Right,
in
the Southern
South,
working
yeah,
class. And certainly, racism is present. There's no question. Yeah. Again, I'm not defending the messaging of Lynyrd Skynyrd. I'm just saying, like, in terms of like an underclass understanding sure. the white sure. working class in the South, that carried those messages.
I'm going to edit this so right. that you are endorsing Lynyrd Skynyrd's lyrics. so that was. A big digression on the music, but that was not a trivial yeah. part of the movie or of the 90s. So like, yeah. it was actually really yeah. good. When we were prepping for this episode, I did not think to prepare for the question of like, what does this movie get right? And there are a few ways to answer that. Is the story good or is like the story plausible, right? Does it represent life in the hood well or correctly? Does it represent our political system well or correctly? So like, how would you guys answer that? Story, fidelity to story, the hood representation, political representation.
So when you say story, do you mean, I mean, I think that that's always a tricky question because like if you have a madcap comedy or a screwball comedy, which is basically what this is, that's going to operate under a very different logic than a realist,
yeah.
than a realist comedy or, you know, science fiction or fantasy or any, you know, there are so many small subgenres of
yeah.
sort of.
Is this believable? Is this, do you think this could happen right. in real life, I guess? Or is it too, is it
no.
fantastical?
Well, I mean, I think it's fantastical, but I also think it's fantastical that like Katharine Hepburn would have a pet leopard. Or jaguar, whatever she had.
That's my plan. No, but I agree. I mean, this is, it is, I mean, just like for a minute, like let's look at like the After Hours Club that they go
right.
to, which is just like this fantasy. It's fantasy. Like there's 40s, after- everyone's smoking blunts. There's plates of ribs,
yeah.
you know.
Dude. I mean, yeah, it's like what it is it's that's a fantasy cooked up by like a white person who's imagining this cool underground hood mm-hmm. black world mm-hmm. that they, you know, they're like, oh, I bet it's like this.
I thought the movie was fantastical or the story was fantastical, but in a way that I wanted to almost be true, you know, like somebody could yeah. do this. And then I thought the representation of the hood was like flat or it was like one dimensional
yeah.
and it leaned pretty yeah. heavily into like racial stereotypes,
right.
which
yeah,
is
so
not great.
Yeah, not great.
But like the politics of it were pretty bang on, particularly in the 90s.
Yeah, I was shocked.
Yeah.
I was shocked by the politics. So going in, like I didn't read any of the reviews or anything. So I went in thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a cringe fest. I'm going to hate it. It's, and I was shocked. Like I really loved it. I thought it, you know, again, like obviously as we've said, like there are some shortcomings there and there are other shortcomings, you know, I think that we can talk about, but yeah, like the politics were correct. I thought it was funny. Like it legitimately, it made me laugh in a way where I was like, oh, I'm going to laugh, but I'm only going to be laughing at it. Mm-hmm. But I actually was laughing at the places where I was intended to laugh.
Yeah. Maybe this is a good point to talk about where this doesn't fit with the culture now, or like to the extent, does it fit with the culture? I mean, so you watched it for the first time a few weeks ago. Yeah. So you've,
yeah.
So in its moment, it was quite radical, but then
yeah.
is it still radical? I mean, is it, or is it just like radically inappropriate because like there are he's got that line about like goes to the black church and he's like, if you don't put down the malt liquor and chicken wings and get behind someone other than a running back who stabs his wife, which is a reference to OJ Simpson for the Gen Z people.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but that's like, again, leaning into those racial stereotypes. He goes to the Hollywood fundraiser and says a bunch of anti-Semitic type stuff. Like, does that fly now? It didn't bother me, but like, I also saw it in the 90s when nobody had hangups about those things the same way.
Yeah. I mean, I think people have too many hangups about these things. Mm. And it's complicated, right? Because I think also in the 90s, you could kind of culturally get away with saying some pretty astoundingly racist and sexist stuff and really mean it. And there weren't many consequences for it. And in fact, you'd be praised as like, or just, you know, not even praised, it would just be normalized. But I think that like, but I think that there, you know, so I think there's been a necessary correction in terms of saying, hey, maybe this, that, and the other thing is not, you know, so cool to say, or it's racist, or it's sexist, or ableist, or homophobic, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is a fear of like, if you're white, basically stepping in to something where you could get like piled on, right? And that's, you know, if you do something and it doesn't hit and it's bad, I don't think people should have to like laud you or say, wow, that was so brave. But I think that I don't know, I'm thinking about like in the literary world, there have been a couple of pretty preposterous discourses about, oh, should you, if you're a fiction writer, should you be allowed to write characters who are not your race or your gender or whatever? And I just think that's ridiculous, because what is fiction, right? What is film? It's making up shit that doesn't exist and using your imagination to occupy the life and experience of someone else. And, you know, and that's not to say, oh, that's, you know, that's all, that it is risky if you don't know what you're talking about, and you could very well be laughed at, but I don't think it's a should you be allowed to thing. See what I'm saying?
That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is also is, you know, could a racist or a bigot or an anti-Semite come away from the movie affirmed in their racism and anti-Semitism?
Yeah, do you think so?
You know, and that's,
it's a very good question.
I think it's tough. I can, but again, for a committed bigot, everything proves the case. And again, this is going, you know, this is what Chappelle dealt with in his crisis when he abandoned his extremely profitable and, in my view, brilliant program in the early 2000s. Was like, it just hit him. He's like, wow, a racist could see these jokes and just be like, yep, it's funny because it's true.
Yeah.
No, and in many cases, again, it's like, I can't tell you how many white fraternity boys I've heard yucking it up over Chappelle in ways that I find a little bit suspicious.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Again, a cultural reference, Chappelle Show, when I was in the military, I was enlisted. So we were like, you know, it was a vulgar place, let's just say. And Chappelle Show was one of those focal points, along with like 50 Cent and, you know, the G Music and the misogyny. And the vulgarity of it all was something we kind of bonded over and relished in a certain way. And looking back, I think I was processing this stuff differently than them, but it was the same cultural objects. And like, that fucks with you. I don't know. It's like imperialists who love Star Wars. It's like, we're seeing the same story, right? You know?
Well, no, but that's great. That goes back to the Rubio loving hip hop thing.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You know,
it's just seeing it at that level. One can experience any form of art at that level if they choose to, and like, that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. There was a New Yorker article at the time that this came out that Matt found in the background research, and it was by Henry Louis Gates, which professor, very celebrated professor. Like, a lot of people know him from the Obama days because he had that sit down with the white cop who arrested him or something at his house.
Yeah.
Yes. And they had a blue moon together. The worst.
The beer summit.
Yeah.
The beer summit.
Yeah. Obama fake brokered peace. And, but so in 98 or 99 or whatever, he writes this thing in the New Yorker about the Bulworth article. Really interesting about the backstory of how this movie got made. Matt, did you like want to reportage this or?
Sure. No, it is a great story. He had, you know, he was going to make Dick Tracy,
Warren Beatty,
which is not a great movie. You know, coming after the success of Batman, everyone was, Michael Keaton, Tim Burton Batman in 89, there was a big interest in Hollywood of kind of like, you know, reviving all these properties. And for some ungodly reason, you know, Warren Beatty decided that kids would be into Dick Tracy, which like, what?
I liked it. For what it's worth, I liked it as a kid, but like, it was not good by any measure.
Yeah, I mean, I was like a nerd about some of this stuff, and I barely knew about who Dick Tracy was. I will say it is interesting to watch, all done in primary colors. It's got Madonna in it, in like,
I know Madonna plays
the height of her powers. I mean,
Malone.
It's got, you know, Al Pacino just absolutely devouring the scenery and everything as he does. But anyway, 20th Century Fox pulled out of the movie after having committed to it, and basically, as Beatty explains to Gates in the article, he basically threatened. He said, basically, I won't sue you, which I can do, if you finance this other project I have in mind. So that's how he got Murdoch to finance Bulworth.
And the caveat up front was that he would have complete creative control, and they didn't know what he was going to do with that. So he like exploited that to do this.
Exactly.
Because you can't imagine Fox or Rupert Murdoch or something like signing off on declaring socialism essential in a like mainstream movie.
That's wild. Thank you for that.
You know, on a side note, I found out that it's a long story how, but the Ruckus Records, which was the indie hip hop label that launched Black Star and Talib Kweli, socially conscious hip hop, that record label was financed by Rupert Murdoch's kid, who was financing it almost as a kind of rebellion against his dad. So it's this guerrilla warfare kind of dialectic thing happening. Total side note, but funny. Yeah. Bulworth's politics, maybe.
Yeah, Bulworth's politics.
What were they?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say it took 25 years for us to get the memo.
Yes.
You know, one thing I wanted to mention here, and I made some this in my notes, it's like, as I mentioned, like this was breaking through. You saw it feed not only the Nader candidacy, but also the global justice movement, you know, the protests against the WTO, the IMF,
this idea of
corporate control, corruption.
Anti-NAFTA, yeah.
But all this stuff got bigfooted by 9/11.
Yes.
You know, and I think that is really important to understand. I mean, certainly it was hurt by the post 2000, you know, the attacks on Nader, but I do remember there being still a good bit of momentum in, you know, in this broader, you know, movement that was just trying to find its feet and mount this critique of the two-party system, the corporate dominated two-party system. But that all that stuff got put aside because you needed to unite and take revenge against the terrorists.
Yeah.
And then also you had, you know, the people on the left went into full like defense mode, being like, okay, let's put that aside for now. Let's only focus on the Iraq War, which obviously I'm not saying that was a bad tech. I mean, the Iraq War, terrible. But I think, like you said, Matt, it all got kind of put aside.
So I'm working on a book right now with Mike Brennis about, it's called The Rivalry Peril. And like one of the things that we know as being on the left, but historically, historians also know this if they're of the right mindset, going back to like World War One, at least, maybe much earlier, every time there's a major war, it shifts the terrain of politics in favor of reactionary politics, and it completely fucking guts any attempts to build like a political equality or economic democracy. Like it's such a subversive.
Beyond Vietnam, he talks about that, and I actually quote that speech in the essay that I'm talking about, which, by the way, it's called Wild as the Taliban, which is what T.I. compared himself to, because I think another thing that hip hop did in the post 9/11 era was it actually allowed us to kind of explore what was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan without really facing it. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of rappers used military imagery and they connected it explicitly with like, I'm a soldier, I'm a drug dealer. It's like the same thing. I'm a troop. I'm, you know, I have these military grade weapons. And, you know, they wore camouflage and that was a big trend at the time.
Living metaphor, yeah.
Living metaphor, exactly. Yeah. But so, right. And I think like, so in the Beyond Vietnam speech, MLK calls it the demonic suction tube. Mm. This taking of grievance and reaction from abroad and bringing it back home, mm-hmm. which is also something yeah. Kathleen Ballou talks about. It's also something Greg Grandin talks about.
Yeah. Not to, I mean, obviously I totally disagree with, you know, the political function of war and the kind of, you know, the political environment that creates, but just to complicate it a bit, going back to Halle Berry's, you know, great speech, you know, in the limo, she talks about World War II and the creation of, you know, the mass industrialization, all these, you know, this military industry jobs for Black folks that created the economic base for the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the New Deal order that gave the civil rights generation its juice. Like it was a condition of possibility for the Malcolm X MLK generation to do what it did. But it's also the New Deal order that got killed in order to do Vietnam, you know? So it's like the problem is with our Washington memory about war as a unifying force is that it cherry picks specifically the one war, World War II, where like, you know, inequality lowers on the back end because it was in a context of Roosevelt pushing the New Deal order, you know? So it's like World War II ended the Great Depression, you know, which is like not nothing, but that's not how World War I functioned. It's not how Vietnam functioned. That's not how Iraq has fucked us in so many ways. And so there's just, and like more than anything, it forces progressives to sort of like either shut up or move right. You don't get neoliberalism without the Vietnam War in a certain perspective. Like that might be overstating it, but like these things are connected in like ways that are pernicious for progressive politics. It's tough.
No, absolutely. And I just finished reading Malcolm Harris's book, Palo Alto, which actually it overlaps a bit with my experiences going out to visit family in the Bay Area and kind of expectations of me growing up. But like he talks at great length about this, right? About the way that the Silicon Valley state was like this sort of, what does he call it? He calls it missile suburbs that were created by Silicon Valley, because a lot of the big post World War II tech boom, really what it was about was military technology, the building up of military technology. But then the other thing he says was that ended up empowering all of these liberation movements, Black power, Native power movements, particularly he looks at California, but obviously around the country, because they had free college. They had these more comfortable springboard from which to mount their concerns, and they weren't coming from, you know, they weren't just going about their days in abject despair and desperation. And so part of dismantling these justice movements was neoliberalism, he argues.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Whether it was an intention in the design is like debatable, but the consequences... Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's Halle Berry's thing, like deindustrialization screwed over Black communities. Yeah.
Well, I think the movie struggles in a way that I think some folks still struggle now, which to kind of are, you know, what is the relationship between race and class?
Yeah. Mm.
You know, how do you talk about things, you know, where, you know, what do you focus on more? How do you talk about them both in the interrelationship? In the maintenance of, you know, the underclass and the dominance of a privileged elite. Mm-hmm. It never really answers that question, but it does kind of throw these out there as, you know, kind of questions.
Yeah. I mean, I cannot stress enough how radical that is in the I mean, even now you don't see that in popular media really, but like in the 90s, people were not talking like this. they weren't right. talking about racial capitalism or the intersection movies, of race right. and class. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not in anything you'd go to the theater and watch.
Yeah.
And nowhere I encountered, you know, I heard plenty of talk about like diversity, but yeah. like, hey, we need to make sure, okay, let's make sure that like we have enough multiracial CEOs and female CEOs. Like I, you know, I grew up like in a very like second wave, like lean in type of household regarding like gender relations, right?
Lean in did not age well. Yeah.
No, it didn't.
Can I make one thing that I thought was particularly hilarious in this movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the beginning, when Vinny, the black ops research guy, shows up, like at the Senate office, and, like they are sitting in his Senate office, and he hands him a suitcase full of bills in the Senate office. It's like, come on, man.
Are you telling me that that didn't happen when you worked for?
You do this in a park. Not that this ever happened when I worked in the Senate. But no, I just thought that was hilarious how this, like, this sweaty, obviously, you know, ne'er-do-well dude shows up in, like, his raincoat. You know.
Yeah. Well, speaking of...
Walks into the Senate.
I was going to ask, like, what you thought, like, the Oliver Platt character was kind of like his chief of staff. And I thought there was like some his sweaty obsessions and like trying to counsel from a place of deference. And like, I thought there was like a lot there about the staffer relationship that was true.
Yeah.
But then he starts like sniffing coke at one point, and I'm like, wait, is that also true? And so I wanted to cross check how close you thought the staffer representation was.
I will address the first point. No, I like that too. I thought he really nailed that. I will say I was struck because, you know, when he walks in the very beginning, he's wearing like a reelect Bullworth button. I mean, that doesn't happen. I mean, the kind of the govern, you know, the Senate and the campaign part and the try to keep separate. Yeah. I know not many offices are probably not as strict in observing those rules as the one I work for, but. I mean, I thought I was struck by that because, you know, he walks in and he is just basically treating the Senate office as part of the reelection operation, talking about polls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the way his relationship with the boss was I thought, really well done because he's trying to like manage Bullworth and increasingly lose control and trying to put like the best possible face on everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that great conversation they have in the After Hours Club, he's like, just explain this new strategy to me. He's like, you know, he believes in his boss so much that he's like, I know there's a strategy here. I know that there's something brilliant you're going to explain. Just let me in on it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. Sure. What about the coke? No comment.
Let's move on.
Yeah. Was there a favorite line that people had in this movie? Like a favorite quote?
I can't remember the whole thing, but like, and we already talked about this, but the Halle Berry speech in the limo, I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also have to, you know, when he comes out and makes the cop apologize to the kids.
Yeah.
And then he says, now you accept his apology. And the kid's like, F you. And he's like, that's good enough.
Yeah. That was.
And that little kid was like, I've been waiting for this my whole life.
That was cathartic. Yeah. The quote I thought was, I don't know, that hit me for some reason when they were at Halle Berry's family's house and then Bullworth decides, which is in South Central, and he decides to go out at night and just leave. She was like asking her parents or whatever, like, you just let him leave. And then one of the guys is like, a U.S. senator ought to be okay among his own constituents. And it hit me because it's logically true to me that, you know, in a healthy democracy, a politician ought to be safe among the people he represents. But it's in context, it's obviously not true that a rich old white guy in gangbanging ass 90s South Central is going to be okay. But that's also like, that's an indictment. Not of South Central. It's an indictment of like the kind of society that we have, which is very much not at peace. It's laughable to us. It's a laugh line that a politician would be safe among the people. How fucked up is that? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, we should be striving toward a society where politicians would be at peace with their constituents. And we're so far from that, you know?
And I mean, I think like a lot of the sort of increase in like security stuff reflects the fact that like politicians have not been doing what's good for their constituents, right? Yeah. And so, like, I remember, like, my dad telling me you used to just be able to pop into any federal building whenever you felt like it in the 70s. And you certainly can't do that now. Yeah. Like, he and his friends would, like, just wander into the Pentagon and play pranks on people in the men's bathroom. You know, you cannot do that now. And so I think, like, yeah, like, the fact that you know, there are all these also, like, it's not totally related, but there are, like, these anti-protest laws of, like, oh, you have to be this far away to protest, you have to get permits and all of this stuff. It reflects not only a decrease basically in free speech, but it is related to the fact that the people in power are generally not doing things that are in their constituents' best interests, and their constituents are quite rightly a little more than a little upset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. I don't know if this is the last question, but at least one of the last ones. Do you think Bullworth presaged Bernie in a way? And do you think it's, like, correct or a misappropriation to say that, like, Trump is expressing that? I know Obama in 2013, he said that he wished he could go full Bullworth, tell the people what it's like. And it, I feel like, to me, that's kind of an indictment of Obama that he would say he wishes he could do that because he could.
Right.
I mean, what?
That's right. You literally can.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but I would answer the question, yes, both in terms, you know, again, it's the people can overstate the similarity between Bernie and Trump, but they both in their own way were telling people that the system is rigged.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is the message that Bullworth is sending. The system is rigged.
Yeah.
And the reason why it resonated is because the system is rigged. You know, I mean, Trump did it in his, you know, bigoted, racist, misogynist, and, you know, disunifying way, as demagogues do. Obviously, I'm biased here, but I think Bernie did it in a much more unifying and constructive way.
Yeah.
But at root, there was a critique of the system. And I think that's what you see from Bullworth. Like I said, it just took 2 decades, unfortunately, for that memo to land. Mm-hmm. You know, it took a series of crises, which you write about in your book, you know, the dot-com bust, the Iraq war, the financial crisis. And it really, you know, there, you know, it's almost a lament to look back and say, we could have heard this message earlier, if only.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people, though, who were, well, not a lot of people, but there were some people who were saying what the truth was, right? You had, like, Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote Nickel and Dimed in 1999, 2000, right. And that was a bestseller, and it got taught at, like, Harvard. I think it was, like, picked for, like, all incoming freshmen to read 1 year. And you had Rage Against the Machine. They were telling it like it was. To a certain extent, you know, certain rappers were telling it like it was. Mm-hmm. And so you had, you know, Bullworth is telling it like it was. So you had these messages, but yeah, it was, you're right, Matt. It does feel like this lament that no one can hear. Like, you had these people who were, I mean, Bernie was telling it like it was, you know, at the time.
Yeah.
Bernie, you know, and you know, he was a senator. He was, right? Or
well, he was in the House at that point.
Oh, he's in the House. Okay. And when did he jump over to being a senator?
In 2012.
Okay, 2012. But he was in the House, right?
Barbara, so
he was just,
Lee, yeah.
So you had these people saying these things, but there was just, yeah, it was like we were all, but it was like so many people were sort of living in this dream that they hadn't woken up from yet.
Yeah, the Bush years were wildly oppressive on the discourse somehow.
Sorry, it was 2006. My bad. A little brain fart there. When Bernie, I had to correct that.
It's all good.
Sorry, you were saying, Van?
No. I was just saying how dystopian the Bush years were.
And again, it put all liberals and progressives and leftists, whatever you were, it put us all on a back foot. You know, just trying to defend. Hey, maybe the government shouldn't read all of our emails and store them in a server somewhere.
What?
Something like that.
Yeah, radical. Okay. Any parting shots, thoughts, anything we missed?
I look forward to the next one.
This was fun as hell, man.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Listeners, viewers, if you were into this, let me know, because this was, I would like to do this again. This was.
Listen, especially if we want to, like, once your book's out and we want to come back and plumb 90s culture.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a whole essay on You've Got Mail.
That was that was on my TV last night randomly. And Dave Chappelle was in it, which I did not know.
He is in it.
Parker Posey? No, there's some folks in that movie.
That's wild. All right. Well, I would love to do this again. This was fun, guys. Thanks for doing it.
All right.
Bulworth, baby.
Thanks for
enjoyed it a lot.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take it easy, guys.
Bye.
All right. Let's see.